It's that time of week, the time you've been waiting for. It's time for Goat Gab, a weekly podcast about all things in the dairy goat industry. Sit back and enjoy an hour or so with your hosts, Laura Warren Hughes and Cameron Jedlowski, as we talk about ideas and topics that matter to the dairy goat world.
Welcome back, Goat Gabbers, to really an awesome episode of Goat Gab, diving into one of the most popular breeds of the goat world here. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Cameron Jodlowski.
I am your other co-host, Laura Warren Hughes. And yes, we are so excited to be looking at another breed, like a deep dive this time, and focusing on a breed that is near and dear to my heart because it was my gateway drug into the world of dairy goats, which is the Nubian breed. And we are really excited today to have two of really just some backbones to the Nubian industry, who both bring their really own unique perspectives in. So we have Paul Fox from Foxwood Nubians in Tennessee and Megan Treadway Carter from Lakeshore Nubians in California. So welcome, guys. And if you'd like to introduce yourselves, that'd be great. Tell us about your herd and your involvement with dairy goats.
This is Paul Fox. I've had Nubians, started breeding them in 1988 and started with one particular line of goats that was here in Tennessee. A breeder that was about an hour and a half from me in Knoxville had some does, and I bought does from her. And basically, the herd today is still descending back to her because I still lay out to her sons and grandsons and her sires. So my herd has a lot of the old Cadillac, and then we brought in some customers because of the Conquest. We like to have Conquest and a little bit of Marvin as well. So over the years, we've tried to merge together some of the older genetics of Conquest, Haas and Cadillac into creating what we have today. And I am one of those breeders who has gone out in the past and bought a nice doe because I really love the doe and I wanted a kid from her. So I would sometimes buy a doe just so I could get a buck, the buck that I wanted to breed her to. Anyway, we've been living here on this farm for 20 years. We had a great dairy for a while. Now it's just a hobby herd. And all the does are bred, I'm hoping, and we start kidding the end of this month.
And Paul, you've had other breeds besides just Nubians.
Yes, we've had Alpines. When we had the dairy, we brought in some Alpines as well and bred those, showed those, and kept those for a few years until we stopped the dairy business. And then I guess 6 or 8 years ago, I saw a Saanen for sale that someone in Tennessee had, and I just hate to see the goat just go off to nowhere. So I ended up buying a Saanen doe that I loved, and we got into Saanens there for a few years as well. But then I've kind of decided at my age and with some health issues I've had, it's just too much to try to handle more than one breed, and sometimes one breed is too much. But we've sold the Saanens now, and luckily, two of the Saanens we sold – both finished that we had bred finished their championships this year. So we've actually bred a couple of Saanen champions and a few Alpine champions, but the emphasis has always been on the Nubians. That's where my heart is.
Megan, would you like to go now, please?
Sure. So my name is Megan Treadway Carter. I live in Northern California, about 2 hours from Sacramento, with my husband, Aaron, who I met at a national goat show, and our two daughters, Bentley and Tegan. I've been raising purebred Nubians under the Lakeshore herd name since 1990, when I purchased my first market goat for our county fair from Patch Quilt Farms. You'll probably remember them from Patch Quilt Farms Dodger. The grand dam of my market goat was Unicorn Farms Patch, as the 92 national champion. Over the years, we've worked with several different bloodlines. We started out with a herd from Linkville that was based out of Oregon. They were also EB Browns. And then we added animals from Castomers, Wingwood Farm, Dayspring, Mangus Colony, and quite a few others over the years. But that was kind of our foundational stock. We've exhibited at 17 national shows over the past 34 years, and we're premier breeder and exhibitor at 8 of those shows. I've also been a licensed ADGA judge for 25 years and had the privilege of judging 2 national shows in 2011 and 2013. In addition to the Nubians, our family also has a herd of Nigerian dwarfs under the Little Misbehavin' herd name that we started raising in 2011 for our oldest daughter, Bentley. And then we had Lamanjas up until 2019 when we sold the majority of the herd and just kept one senior doe. But we are still active. We kind of did a step back from attending the national shows once we had children, because it's a little bit harder to navigate. But we have come back the last few years, made 5 of the last 13 national shows, I think. And hopefully we can hit more as the years continue.
Yes, thank you. We're really excited to have you guys here. Let's kind of kick off kind of this here, just kind of update and kind of see what's happening on the farm level here. Paul, I want to start with you because you're in a little bit more of a different climate than us. And I want to see here, when do you start kidding?
Well, my first one was due January the 28th, and she actually aborted earlier this week. But I have a couple due early February, then about the middle of February through April is when all the others will be kidding. Generally, I like them to start freshening about the 1st of March. But this year, I don't know what's wrong with me in the fall, but I decided to go ahead and breed earlier. So some of the older does that I knew I probably wouldn't show, I went ahead and bred them early so I could have some February kids, maybe for nationals. And all the does, as far as I know, are bred up to this point, even though I just bred one last week. And so I'll be having, you know, July babies or June babies.
So, hey, there's nothing wrong with that, Paul. I've got one that's supposed to come into heat tomorrow. So...
Good luck. Well, it's kind of hard to show because I generally do the showing by myself and the milking home by myself. So it's hard to show when I have does that are due to kid, as I can't haul them all with me. And then I try to haul all the milkers I can with me to the show so no one has to come over here and try to milk. So it's kind of nice if I don't have does due to kid about the time I'm showing, which can happen in June. So... But I'll take a doe kid anytime I can get it.
And Megan, kidding season for you has already started, if I saw on Facebook, correct?
That is correct. We started last weekend, primarily with my daughter's boar herd, so that she has some market goats for the county fair that happens in September. And then we realized we needed some milk to help feed all these boar kids. So we kitted out a couple of La Mancha dry yearlings that had crossbred kids. And then we have another Nubian dry yearling kitting tomorrow, as well as a Nigerian. But then we're taking a break from kidding until the end of February because we're going on a family vacation in February. So the goats are taking a break and we'll get going with the dairy goats kidding that end of February when we return home.
I like the idea of a vacation before kidding season. I think that's a great idea.
It's something that I always like think, gosh, how can you make that happen? But we've done a couple trips with my parents to Hawaii in January, February. And I just calendar out. And so we have a really good chore help that comes and does all the chores. And she likes it because the youngest babies are already Lambar trained. And she knows that no goats will be kidding for at least 10 days till after we get home. So it's kind of a win-win for us. But once we get thick into kidding season, you know, March and April, that is definitely not doable to get away from the farm. But January, February, we tend to be able to make it happen.
We need to do like an ode to outstanding farm help because, you know, I hear Cameron say very often, you know, his chore boy is just fantastic. And you're mentioning that. And I know that I can't sing the praises of my family often enough, my extended family, because they're all goat people and they can come and chore for me if needed. And it does take a village. You just have to have good help.
I need to find some good help.
Well, if you're a listener in Paul Fox's area, get a hold of him.
Come on, Hofer. And help.
Well, Megan, I take my second vacation of January, as I'll call it, here next week because I'm judging a show in Florida and my wife is going with me, which is nice and serves as both a tax write-off and a vacation, quote unquote. And then I also don't have to hear, well, you never take me anywhere fun when you judge. So I'm really excited about that.
But the question is, will you do anything fun while you're there, or will you just be trying out all the fair food?
No. I don't know about that. That's a really good question. Unsure. To be determined.
Does Catherine help rate the food too, or
she hasn't had the opportunity to be part of one yet. Plus, I don't think she lies the same stomach that I do for all the weird food that I like to eat. So,
Cameron, very few people have the same stomach. I'm just going to leave it there. I would need kaopectate if I ate the way that you have eaten at fairs. I'm really impressed, actually. So. Oh.
I have a good time. That's the important thing there on that. And sort of the people on Facebook. So
yeah, we've all watched. We all enjoy.
Yeah,
live vicariously through Cameron.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, I've got people that want to judge these goat shows now because they want to eat the food. So really, I'm doing the community a service. That's kind of all that's happening at my place. Not much. It's just bitterly cold. It's kind of the same like most of the Midwest. Wouldn't you agree, Laura?
Oh gosh, yes. I honestly, I don't think I've ever had it this cold here ever. It's so cold.
The only goat of mine that was outside was my goat that I got from the West Coast. And I don't know if it's like, she's just like, she doesn't need to be inside. She likes the sun when it's shining on her. I don't really know, but something about those West Coast goats, let me tell you that.
Well, the only goat I've seen outside today is my buck that came from the same herd. So maybe it is something that is just in their makeup, but yeah. Different breed, Cameron. So I don't know. We'll have to see. But he was the only one outside today in the sunshine too. So.
Yes. Laura, before we dive into the topic here, do you want to tell the listeners some Goat Gab news?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Yes, I do. So we are wrapping up the final tallying of things from our circuit, our showmanship circuit. So if you have papers that you've been hanging on to from that, please go ahead and get those in. And we are very excited to be awarding our first year of winners for the circuit, and I think it's going to be pretty exciting for the winners too. So February 1st, you can expect the announcement of our winners in the different age groups. So I think that's going to be fun to see how that wraps up.
Absolutely on that there. Also on the ADGA front here, don't forget to sign up for Linear Appraisal and your ADGA Plus by the end of January. They do have a new button in which you will be able to see ADGA Plus on your under your subscription list, under your account, and it'll also have all of your DNA information on there as well from those. So I had the opportunity to see that in action here this week. So really excited about that as well. So get those in, and all of those should be processed through the office rather shortly.
So Cameron, I don't know about you, but I know that I've had some other members who've asked me why is it worth doing ADGA Plus when, you know, things still aren't showing up in pedigrees and an NG and so forth. And do you have any good answers on that? I know what I say, but.
Well, I mean, what's the value of your data? You know, do you want that information in order to make data back decisions on your DHIR? And I know you can do it outside of the ADGA realm as well there, but again, when those do get awarded, you know, all the milk stars and other things there, because they're going to retroactively give those as well. And then again, the opportunity to sign up for Linear Appraisal and use that own information, not just in your herd, but to other make genetic decisions as well. I mean, it's coming. It's just going to take time. And I will tell you that Linear Appraisal, again, is not just a marketing thing. It is a how do you improve your herd on a whole basis situation. So
I would agree with that. And also, you know, especially with the new requirements for DNA on bucks, it makes sense to me to go ahead and sign up for that because you get your DNA at a reduced rate. So, you know, why not?
Save money. Yes.
Yeah.
So one thing. Well, I kind of want to just jump into this, Laura, here. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do it.
All right. So Megan and Paul, the history of the Nubian breed. I'm not a Nubian enthusiast. I did own one for one period of time. There's a picture that I will put on Facebook for all the people to see at some point. I kind of want to start with you guys here. Let's kind of jump in here. Let's talk about the origin of the breed there as well. And where did they come from and how did they get over to the United States here?
So Paul has done a whole bunch of background work on this, and I tried to kind of summarize it. Paul, I'd really like you to jump in if I've missed something in this little summary, but okay. Basically it looks like our Nubians can be traced back to 6 bucks and 8 does on an English import, correct?
I think so. I think that's correct. From the Anglo-Nubian idea.
Yeah. And so, Paul, with your permission, I'm going to share the resources that you sent to me on our Facebook page, if that's okay. Because I found it really fascinating, the older articles, and then also some pictures of those Nubians back then. Something that I just thought was funny, you know, moon spots. You hear everybody oohing and aahing over moon spots, whether it's Nubians or Nigerians. But boy, those first Nubians, there were a lot of spots in those animals.
Wow.
I mean, kind of crazy. So I guess you can understand, you know, where that came from. There were also 2 bucks and 12 does that were imported into Canada. And back then when the borders were open and animals were imported and exported across the US-Canadian border, a lot of bloodlines in Nubians and also other breeds were shared back in the beginning as well. So those animals were a good influence here. Paul also mentioned about some Nubians that were imported in 1909 by Dr. R.J. Gregg in California. So the first 3 does that were registered in our current herd books were Holly Lodge Shingle 463 and twin does Wigmore Brownie 464 and Wigmore Pansy 465. Paul, do you know, or any of you guys, do you know anything about this number, about these numbers? Were those like just automatically added or just something that they did back then? Do you know anything about that?
Megan may know. All I really know much about is a lot of the information that I can actually find to make some connections to starts with 1940. A lot of the, like the goats that were registered through Ag Genetics and are on the NG and Ag, the first one that I can come up with is a doe that was born 229-1940, or it could have been a buck. And it belonged to Hurricane Acres, or they purchased it and used it as a foundation animal. So there was a big lapse, you know, but from the time the goats started being imported in the United States, there's a lapse in our registry that I have access to that tells how these animals that came up in the 1940s, how they actually descend from any of those original imports. I can't make those connections because I can't access that information.
Maybe something the Adga History group would like to work on eventually.
If they can find the... Yeah,
and I was going to say too, like, I don't have a lot of knowledge back to those early imports. Because in that article that Paul had shared from 1979, what I found interesting in it was the herds that were listed as being in that and contributing to the breed. Today, there's like three or four herds that are still actively breeding goats. So a lot of my history comes from when we got into goats, like from the early 80s, even some back to the 70s, of herds that I'm familiar with. Although some of the names of those original animals in the 40s and 50s that Paul outlined, you know, helped build were the foundation animals behind popular herds that many of us know those bucks today.
Because one thing I thought was interesting, you know, when I went back and looked at the first ones registered through NG or through Ag Genetics starting in 1940, I've listed here 21 of them because these were names I was kind of somewhat familiar with because they were used in Hurricane Acres, Albania, Oakwood. I guess those are the Cadillac. So those are the herds that I'd heard about all my life when I go back and look at old pedigrees. And 21 of those animals, first animals, went back to those herds. But then I actually looked at current animals, like last year's national champion and Megan's reserve national champion. And both those does go back to every single one of those 21 animals. So I thought that was kind of neat that those genetics of those animals all ended up in the herds that contribute to making what we see and appreciate today. And part of it was through a few big bucks that came along like in the late 60s and 70s, like Purebred Acres A&M Conquest, who was, you know, used line bred heavily to produce Carrington Acres Royal Majesty. It was actually 35.56% inbred. So Carrington Acres Royal Majesty was used in the Castamere herd, and so many of today's goats descend from Castamers that there aren't a lot of goats out there that probably wouldn't have Purebred Acres A&M Conquest in their background. Plus, he had some really, daughters out of a particular doe that were foundation does for Longman, Silver Thistle, and Royal Cedars. And, you know, they still have a lot of descendants from those three does, the Candy, No Jelly, Orange, and Lemon, that we still see today.
Yeah, I think it's funny, or it's interesting to me that, and I meant to look it up, and I had forgotten to look up the number of goats each year that are registered out of each breed. But I know that before the Nigerians came on the scene, Nubians always eclipsed the other breeds. I mean, they had so many that were registered. But yet, really, for all the animals that there are in Nubians, it's a fairly small-ish gene pool if you take a look at it that way.
That's what I was thinking when I pulled up Conquest, Hacienda Austin Marvin, Longman's Barnby Bug, Hunter Springs King Edward, and I've added that one since we talked. And then Gasconade's Netted Honorable because, you know, Crown Ambassador goes back to that bug. But just looking at those and how they're overlapping with the foundation animals that they came from, to me it was just kind of interesting because it is kind of a small gene pool. But there were lots and lots of these goats being registered back earlier. Megan mentioned the Dairy Goat Journal from November of 79, where I'd listed the herds that had sales ads in there. Well, I went ahead and added to that today those from March 1980. So I've got a list that includes those from 79, November 79 and March of 1980. And there were 115 Nubian herds they were advertising back then. And it's just amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. That's a lot. Today. How many herds do we even have? And I kind of miss those journals and magazines too, because today, you know, everything's on internet and Facebook or whatever. And I kind of miss seeing these ads and being reminded of all these herds. But like Megan said, a lot of these herds aren't around anymore. Some of them are.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring up the Facebook and Dairy Goat Journals and stuff, because I was thinking the same thing as I was, just kind of brainstorming about the session on all the years that I poured through the Dairy Goat Journals, the UCNs. I have boxes of old sales lists from herds. And that with modern technology and the use of web pages and now Facebook, a lot of that historical data isn't as readily at your fingertips that it used to be. And that's how so much of the knowledge of the breed I felt came from when I was starting, is looking at all those old herd brochures. And I really think it's kind of becoming a lost art. I know Julie Mathis had posted she had brought home some from her parents' house, and it triggered me. I was like, oh my gosh, I have all those out in my garage. And that's where you really saw the succession of the breed and what breeders were working on, the genetics they were crossing, is in those sales lists from year to year to year.
So Megan and Paul, I want to kind of build on that here a little bit. Here is, what kind of trends did you see, maybe looking at those initial ones there? How were people breeding goats? Like, what specific traits were people looking for in Nubians? And then how has that kind of evolved over time? Kind of a compound question, but I'm kind of curious.
I think we have been good with the addition of like agrogenetics. It's much more readily available to be able to piece together your pedigrees using it that way in planned breedings versus having to do it all on paper many years ago. But I think when you start looking at those old pedigrees, you saw how many times breedings tied in and like the inbred coefficients that you were seeing, when now you see a lot of really nice goats and you just kind of like throw those genetics together and see if it's going to work. When I think Nubians need a lot more planning and breeding on different traits and structure because they aren't a consistent breed.
The gene pool may be small, but it's varied. But a lot of the does that you would see in those journals from like the 60s, you would see a large doe, lots of times high on the hips, maybe have a beautiful head and somewhat of a pendulous top udder. And then you would see a more stylish top of doe with a more snug udder. So there's just a mix. You could kind of see from one extreme of dairiness to a different extreme of a coarser, larger framed animal that looked like it would milk, you know, 18 pounds a day, you know, on an udder that was maybe low to the ground, but she had the, I guess, dairy strength to produce a lot of milk.
Yeah. So some of those pictures come to mind that I see, you know, the ones with the teeth or the udder floor that is 3 inches below the hocks and no foreudder attachment and just a huge body doe with a huger udder for bad grammar there, but you know what I mean.
And it did improve a lot, though, from those magazines that I have from the 70s and early 80s. There was a lot of progress toward the middle of the 80s. You know, when you think of Mount Mama and Gabriel and Sun Tierra and some of those does, nice does that came along in the 80s. And then you look back 10 years early and see these pictures, and it's like, how did they get from where they were to where they are with breeding? But I think one thing, there are a few bucks like the Conquest buck, Purebred Acrosanium Conquest. He was a good udder buck. You know, may have thrown steep rumps and plain heads or whatever, but I think eventually they figured out how to cross a good udder buck with a line that had stylish, correct does to come up with a better overall package. So I just think it took a while to figure out. And of course, there's a lot of calling along the way, you know, do those crosses and cold heavy, and eventually they got the genetics, I guess, more refined to something that is more consistent in producing nice animals.
Adding to Paul on that, I think when you look back to some of those old animals, when you mention the Sancerre Gabriel, Mountain Mama, Sun Tierra, like they were kind of anomalies for their era. And then, but you saw those pop up every so often, like at a national show, there would be a doe that would just kind of set that new standard of where the breed was trying to go. But then the bulk of the animals were still kind of some of those older style. And I think it's through those years of intense culling that we have put together where the style of the Nubian is changing and where you're getting more of a consistent type look than what we see in some of those, you know, older pedigreed animals.
A lot of progress on the quality, overall quality, has been made in 40 years. There were the exceptional animals years ago, but I remember going to Nationals, I guess 92 was my first one. There may have been really 5 or 6 strong does in a class, and some of the others just like, well, they could place those just about anyway, maybe. And then now you go to a national show and it's like maybe 20 does in the class. And it's like, well, those are all, there are 20 nice does there. All 20 of those could have been in the top 5 back in 1992, probably. So it just made a lot of progress.
I want to get a little bit more into the nuggets of the breed here. Let's talk about purebred Nubians. And it seems like everybody has purebred Nubians and that's the hot thing they want. So what's the allure to purebred Nubians versus American Nubians?
I think it's comes down to the Nubians having the closed herd book that the longtime breeders and developers in the Nubian breed have always prioritized having the purebred Nubian, and that there's always been a demand for them, even when it comes to exports. You know, we've sent some animals to the Philippines and they come over, they're like, we want Anglo Nubians. And it's like, okay, we don't call them Anglo Nubians, but it's one of those things that's always been known and expected that purebred Nubians are the way to go.
And I think part of it too is the marketing. I don't think there's as much of a market for especially American bucks or American oaks just within the Nubian range. You know, I had the Saanens and we had American Saanens, our Alpines, most of those were Americans. And there seemed to be just as much demand for the progeny of American Saanens and Alpines as there were for purebreds. But with the Nubians, and I've never really kept American Nubians, it's just based on what I've heard and maybe observed a little, but I just don't know that there's much demand because it cuts your market down because a purebred breeder will not purchase an American buck breed to a herd of purebred Nubians. But the purebred bucks can go into the American herds or the Nubian herds. So the potential customers are greater if you're marketing purebred Nubians than if you have some Americans.
Maybe I've looked at it in too much of a simple way, but I always thought Nubian breeders tend to want to stay with purebred, frankly, because airplane ears are just, they're just not as attractive. I'm sorry, but you know, when you have the only breed that has the long pendulous ears and the Nubian, beautiful Nubian nose, and you cross it with anything else, you're going to be losing that. Maybe that's too simple to look at it that way, but I always thought that was a great incentive to keep purebreds pure.
It may, but there have been a couple of national champions that were American.
When you describe that, Laura, for the Nubians, the airplane ears, like when I think of American Nubians, I'm thinking of American Nubians that have been breeding true for several generations. I'm not thinking of the ones that, you know, were an experimental cross to an Alpine or a Saanen. Because there are herds that are raising both purebred Nubians and American Nubians. And I've always felt that with the Americans, that once a really good American came through, like winning a national show, we might see a change in that. But I think it goes to that old standby of once an American, always an American. And that like a phenomenal Nubian that comes to my mind was the 2012 national champion in Wingwood Farm Talk, Sasha. I wasn't even in that class and I walked by the ring and I saw her out there and I'm like, oh my gosh, that goat has got to be the national champion this year. And I mean, the goat that struck me so, I still remember it, you know, 14 years later, 12 years later, that she didn't even elevate the breed to being accepting of American Nubians. I just think it's the once an American, always an American.
Well, in Redwood Hills, I remember, was her name Gretel's Velvet Fennel? Was that, did I get that name right? She was a former national champion that was an American, correct?
Yes.
And I think the 2010 national champion was also an American. And beautiful does. I mean, all of them. But I think you're right. It's just interesting to me that Americans have been so accepted in all of the other standard breeds, but it just seems like they don't get a very good toehold in the Nubians.
I agree. And I, speaking of the breed character, though, I do get a few shorter ears sometimes with this Cadillac Pat Crown. So they may be purebred, but sometimes the ears aren't quite as long as some of those Marvin ears.
So is there a desired length of Nubian ear? Like, have you ever like measured the inches of the ear, or is it just like a look?
It's based on the length of the head to the nose, you know, length of the a longer head would require a longer ear than a shorter head.
Yeah, and they always say like the Nubian ear needs to reach to the end of the muzzle. But I've had some short-eared ones that, yeah, you can pull them down to the end of the muzzle, but when they're not pulled down, they're not looking too pretty. So I think it's that natural length and the way that they lay flat on the heads that gives them that beauty, not just the length of the ear.
I want to talk about something else that I think is beautiful about Nubians. Their milk. In my book, Nubian milk, there is nothing that comes close to it. Best flavor, best cheese making. I just think Nubians make amazing milk.
I agree.
until you got the Nigerians.
Exactly. I mean, the Nigerians are the only ones that can beat them out on butterfat. You just don't get quite the quantity. But I would agree, the Nubian is the best. Nigerian is probably a little bit better.
Uh-oh.
I would rather milk a Nubian than a Nigerian. Sorry. Just the teat size if I'm going to hand milk. I don't do with mouse sized teats, but that's just me. So
see, that's why you machine milk. Then it doesn't matter.
You know, it was interesting. I spent some time today going through the history of the national champions of the last, I guess, all 60 years since the original national show. And I noticed a little bit of a difference between the East Coast versus the West Coast and some of the geographical differences as well here. And what I think is going to make this really interesting is, Megan, you're from California, and Paul, you're from Tennessee, and kind of have that East and West Coast balance. Do you guys ever notice that there's a difference between those two styles of Nubian as compared to each other, or what?
I don't notice as much of a difference. And I think it's because so many of the goats in this area today have the West Coast genetics in them. You know, Karen did such a good job of marketing her goats and producing some great animals, and goats of her ended up with Lakeshore, and Lakeshore did a good job of merging those genetics with other genetics. And then the genetics from Lakeshore and Castomers and Wingwood all headed east. So most herds today that you find in the east have a lot of the West Coast genetics in them. So I think the styles are more like today probably than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And that's just because the influence of bringing in a lot of Lakeshore, Castomer, Wingwood into this area.
And I think I agree with that too. When we first started hitting the national show circuit, I think there was a bigger difference. This is, you know, the mid 90s, early 2000s. When we would like travel all the way back to Massachusetts, I do think there was a difference in looking at the two different styles of goats. But over the years, with the widespread ability to airship and then ground transportation options, and combined with the collecting of bucks and semen available for sale, and so many people AIing, I think that the same genetics are now available from coast to coast, that there isn't as much difference between the East and the West. And like, in my opinion, I think the biggest difference is each breeder's personal preference of their style and type. But then I think there's also differences as far as, you know, climate, feed sources, and the parasites that are prevalent to each region that would change the way animals, you know, develop and mature and produce.
I agree.
So as you, you know, you both have been in the breed for 30 or so years. So how do you feel about the goats today compared with goats when you first started in, as far as, are we making progress in the Nubian breed? Are we continuing to improve at the rate that maybe other breeds are improving? And you know, how do you feel about that now?
The really good goats from years past would still be really good goats today. It's just today, because of people doing a good job of breeding, we've weeded out a lot of those weaker genetics, and the proportion of good goats in herds is much higher today than it would have been 35 years ago. But I think, you know, if you look at the national champion this year and the reserve national champion, those are beautiful does. And I don't know where we go from there, because it seems like we get to the ideal animal, or almost ideal in our minds, and it's like, where do we go to there? And how do we maintain that and not regress? So I think I'm not sure where we go from here. We all want a balanced goat, but balanced, each one of us may be a little bit different. Some of us may want more dairiness, some may want more strength, some may want a huge udder, and some may want, you know, a tighter udder that still produces well. So I think each breeder is just going to kind of come up with what they want to see in their herds and breed for that. And at least that's what I'm doing.
I agree with that, Paul. As I've, you know, thought back on this, I feel that in the past, like those goats that were winning 20, 30 years ago, they were does that could still walk out today and do very well, that there's so many different styles of Nubians, though, that I think the push is for a complete package and balanced dough, like you said, and getting that style, that the goat today needs to have all the components of the scorecard to be considered exceptional, not just the mammary system that we used to see in the past, but they need that overall general appearance to go with it. They need that dairy strength, just that real balance. And I think it's how each breeder looks at that balance for where they're striving their own breeding program to be going.
So what I hear you saying is the top animals that we saw, you know, 30 years ago would still be towards the top today. We just have a lot more, the proportion of outstanding animals has really increased in the Nubian breed versus what it was back then. We've done a good job of just really moving the bar up higher all along.
Exactly. And like Paul said, when you go to the National Goat Show and, you know, you have a class of 60 Nubians in the ring and they can only choose 20 and you see animals leaving that you're like, gosh, that's a really pretty goat, but didn't make that cut. It just really shows the depth and the quality that herds are coming out with now, when before a herd would have, you know, a handful of exceptional does.
So what traits do you guys, have you guys seen throughout your years of breeding Nubians that have really maybe increased in terms of they've gotten better or maybe they've gotten worse or maybe just throughout the breed as a whole?
Well, number one is mammary. I think mammaries have tremendously improved over the years. So that to me is the greatest strength of improvement from, you know, 20 or 30 years ago is just the mammary systems. You go to national shows now and the class, every goat in there may have an exceptional mammary system. And you didn't see that years ago. I think one thing sometimes, though, something that may not be stronger, and I may just not be remembering it the way it really was, but it seems like now some does dip more behind the withers into the chine than it seemed like those in the past. Lots of those are stronger from the withers back to the hips. And it may just be the way I'm recalling things, which may not be realistic, but it seems like now you see a lot of goats, even in pictures, it looks like the withers are really high. And then there's a dip down to, I guess, the chine area, and then on back to the hips.
I've kind of noticed just in looking at Nubians, you know, as not a current breeder, but still love the breed. I feel like that front ends have really changed a lot in 30 years on Nubians. It seems to me like that you don't see that extension of brisket in the width, and you see a lot more animals, especially younger animals, that are almost sunken in the chest and really tight at the point of elbow. It could also just be a more regional thing, but is that something that anybody else has kind of noticed?
Well, my theory on that, I do think you're onto something, is that, you know, back several years ago, there were exceptions given to the Nubian breed when it came to like the industry standards as far as appraisal and show, which allowed for their breed characteristics and traits that they had always been known for, like their mammary strength. They were does that were deeper body, higher on the hips, wider shoulders, to be successful. But then about 15, 20 years ago, there started being this industry-wide shift where the emphasis was no longer about breed-specific strengths, but the dairy goat as a complete package, regardless of their breed. And when that started happening, I know in my herd personally, I was like, okay, udders aren't going to do it no more. You're going to have that dairy strength. You're going to have that tall, upstanding front end. You're going to need the levelness across the back and the rump to be able to compete against other breeds when you are, you know, competing for best in show or trying to get the same linear appraisal scores that you saw coming out in like these Alpines and Saunen does, that you had to have those other elements. And so I think we kind of started losing some of what the Nubian breed has been known for when you go back 30, 40 years ago.
I could not agree more with you, Megan, on that, because I noticed the trend too out judging that, you know, you're seeing these Nubians that might not necessarily, they have some, and I don't know if it's a whole front end issue or if it's a whole structural, how it is with the withers and how it just kind of dips back down into that back area there. But I've noticed that trend as well. Not necessarily it's a good thing, and does make the animal look sometimes a little strange as well.
So that's maybe correlating with the adoption of a unified scorecard?
Well, I think we've always had that unified scorecard, but I think it's the way it's being applied when you're looking at the principles of, like, you know, how the judges are being trained that, you know, regardless of the breed, this is the what we want. You know, linear appraisal, don't look at the breed. These are the traits that you're not taking into account, that each breed kind of has their own key strengths and weaknesses. And before, there was some ability to kind of manipulate that based on the breed. And now I'm not seeing that as frequently. And like, I'm kind of pinpointing it back to like the last 15 to 20 years where I started noticing, you know, my own herd started changing because I'm like, to keep up with these other areas, I'm going to have to start making these changes. So like, I wanted good udders, but it wasn't my end all. When before that was my end all breeding purpose, was to be known for those udders. And so now it was trying to get some added dairy strength into the herd because that's the animals that were winning, like for best in show, was dairy strength.
Gotcha. I mean, that makes a lot of sense there in that. And we know that, Megan, you're in a very competitive part of the country as well as in, and going up against beautiful does nonetheless there. So I get that as well. I do want to kind of circle back to kind of the traditional thought of the Nubian and being a dual purpose animal there. Obviously it's got milk and meat functionality there in that. We've definitely moved away from that on the dairy side there, but do you still think there are some traits that the Nubian possesses that does kind of show off some of its dual purposeness there?
I guess I think when you look at a dry yearling class, you can definitely see the feed efficiency that the Nubians have. and they're able to pack that weight on pretty good. Sorry, I don't mean any offense by that, but goodness gracious, if you ran those does across to scale, I think some of them would tip well over 200 pounds.
Well, one thing from my herd, it seemed like when we had the Saanens, a lot of our Saanens had just as much strength and power as our Nubians. So if our Nubians had been white and had Saanen heads, it would be hard to tell some of them apart. But we didn't have the Saanens that were milking 20 pounds a day, you know, so that was a difference too, I guess, with the look. But our Saanens were able to pack on the pounds if they were dry. And a junior Saanen kid grew like crazy and would weigh 70 pounds at 3 months with no problems. They would outgrow the Nubians. So, and I don't know how much now people consider the Nubians to be a dual purpose breed. I know some people talk about it, but I know at Nationals a couple of years ago, the national judge said, you know, Nubians, you know, this is the American Dairy Goat Association, so expect Nubians to be dairy goats. So I'm not sure how much emphasis now, you know, in linear appraisal or showing that people are putting on the dual purpose part. I just don't know. And you know, Megan, you're a judge, you would know that, but I don't know.
Well, I think there tends to be pockets of success where people, you know, want that really high milk production or they want the show purpose. The herds that tend to do the show and milk combined don't necessarily have as high of standards for the milk ability. It's more they need to milk enough for the show ability side. And I mean, we've had some goats that have been top 10, 3,000 pound milkers, but that's not a guideline in my herd. I've always said if a doe can make enough milk to fill her udder in a reasonable amount of time for a show, that's enough milk for me. I mean, I wouldn't be on milk test if Aaron wasn't involved. He is all about the numbers and wants milk test. But I think like for us, it's more, I guess you are saying it's dual purpose, but I'm not seeing like the high peaks of milk production because you're just trying basically for the show intent of it.
I would agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so one last kind of question I have, and then I want to get into the goats because that's really what we live for here. And you can't have an episode about Nubians without talking about my favorite, Frosty Marvin. But I want to talk about, and this kind of relates to Frosty Marvin, if my knowledge is correct here, the G6S deficiency or gene as we see it here, It's really more prevalent in the Nubian breed here. Do you guys want to kind of explain a little bit what that is and why it's maybe not why it's so prevalent, but why it's such a big issue in the Nubians here?
So the issue in the Nubians is that it's a gene mutation that is only found in the Nubian breed and those who descend from the Nubian breed. And animals are either normal, carrier, or affected. And now as more testing is more widespread, you're seeing people claiming normal by parentage, meaning that both parents are normal, so the resulting progeny have to be normal. The status is only known through lab testing, blood or hair. But then I think the testing, too, also raises questions on, like, the ownership of the records. When you test through ADGA, then ADGA owns the records and they have the release of them. If you test through, like, Texas A&M, those results are yours themselves. There's lots of Nubians in the past, famous ones, that are carriers, are known carriers. And I kind of feel that it started gaining attention in the like 2010s when mini herds began widespread testing shortly after. But it became almost like a witch hunt in a blame game in my mind on people like, how can you breed goats with G6S when it was really about understanding and managing the genetics of not breeding carrier to carrier. And then there were also a lot of questions on the relevance of the testing. We personally didn't start testing until around 2015 because we then found that we had some bloodlines from herds that were part of that witch hunt. And so we're like, okay, we better start testing. And I mean, I've had some carrier does and I've just tested all their progeny. I haven't used it as necessarily a culling strategy. Today, though, I don't have any carrier animals, but it's not to say that I wouldn't be willing to have a carrier animal again.
Well, I have one carrier doe, and I bought her as a carrier doe probably 5 years ago because I wanted a son from her because I liked her pedigree and I liked her looks enough that I wanted to breed her to my buck and get a son from her. So we test every kid that she has, and a little over half, or right at half, have been carriers. And we haven't sold any carriers as registered kids. So with us, the G6S stops with her and from our herd. But she is nice enough that we wanted to keep her and try to keep any kid that we can get from her that is a non-carrier.
Okay, guys, I've got a dumb question, but maybe if it's a dumb question on my part, other people have this too. Have you seen animals that express that gene, and what do you see in that for maybe some of our newer folks?
I haven't seen it because I've only had the one carrier. I've only read about the effects that kids don't live to be very old and nearly die fairly young. Megan may know more about it than I do. I just know what I've read over the years.
Yeah, I haven't ever seen any goats that would have been tested as affected. The carrier animals, I find it interesting because, you know, we used unknowingly, we used a carrier buck, and I had a set of quad doe kids born. And of the four kids, the fanciest kid in the litter was the carrier doe. And I ended up keeping her because nobody wants to buy a carrier. So I kept her, and she ended up winning junior national champion. And she was stunning. And then over the years, you know, using her, produced another one of my best goats, who was a carrier. The two of the littermate sisters were not carriers, but they were not nearly as they didn't reproduce as well or turn out as well as the carrier doe. And so then I started thinking, I'm like, what the heck is this with G6S? The carriers are like the better goats. And that was just like a comparison that I saw, like, in a smaller herd and seeing those. But I mean, the problem isn't carriers are fine. It's just like Paul said, you know, 50% of their kids will have that genetic mutation and test to be carrier, but then the other 50% can be normal and work just fine. So I mean, it is something that just affects the Nubian breed, but it's not the end all. It's not don't have a carrier goat. It's just you have to know that you have to test their kids and to manage it properly. And so, like, we test all of our bucks and have been, you know, working on testing through the does and getting normal by parentage status. But I think it's just knowledge.
And there have been national champions that were carriers. So carriers can be great goats.
Well, that is true. Really,
like anything else that it's like anything else that you test for, know what you have, know how to manage it, and move forward with that. Be honest, you know, be transparent and go on. I think witch hunt is an interesting term to use and very descriptive of sometimes how people jump on things like this.
Right. Now, we haven't sold any of the carriers as registered animals. One thing, you know, I just worried that I would sell the a kid as a carrier to someone, and then that person later on would sell it to someone else, not inform them of the carrier status, and then it would kind of come back to me. It's like I sold it, so I just won't sell the carriers. You know, we have a neighbor, a high school kid, who buys our kids from us at a couple of days sold, and she'll get those when they're 3 or 4 weeks old as soon as I get results back and take them off our hands. But I don't sell any of them with registration papers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So let's talk about favorite, like the great ones that are long. And we kind of made a list, but it's definitely not a comprehensive list because there's lots of other bucks. So Paul, can we talk about the first one that I listed up there?
Oh, I don't see your list.
Okay. So that would be Cadillac Ramo Pats R.
Oh, Pats R.
Pats R. So 53 registered offspring are listed in NG on that, or in Ag Genetics on that buck. But he only had offspring registered from 1973 to 1975. And what I thought was really cool about that, of the 53 that were registered, he had 14 that were champions.
Oh, yeah. And maybe even national champions.
Several. Yeah. Let's see. Patsar Polly was the 79 national champion. And I know that he had some class winners that were daughters and so forth. But kind of a cool buck. And if you look on, there's a website called ADGA National Show History. Weebly.com. And you can go there and look, and they've got all kinds of old national champions, and it's pretty amazing to see some of these does. And Polly herself especially, I think, could be competitive today.
Well, that was Polaris's dam. And then Snickers is another one that did very well. But you mentioned Patsar, though, and on a sheet of paper, I had gone through AgriGenetics, and for some of those books I had listed, I looked at the top 10 animals listed for their inbreeding. So I looked at Piehar, who's Cadillac as well, and Cadillac Patsar, and they were born 2 years apart. Patsar was 2 years ahead. But the order of the top 10 of their inbreeding was exactly the same. So the animal they were most likely or most heavily inbred on was Proctor's Carlos of Avania. It was 37.89% inbred. Now, Avania really inbred heavily. And then Chief of Avania was 37.89% inbred. So they did a lot of inbreeding. But I just thought it was kind of neat because I've worked more with Piehar, and then I had Patsar too through the Faith Farm book. I had Genesis. But I had never realized how closely their breedings were, that the top 10 animals contributing to their inbreeding were the same top 10 animals in the same order.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. To me, that was kind of neat. Yeah, Parker's Patsar did a great job and used their Mir Hill in Virginia, who went on and sold great animals even to your relatives, I believe, your family.
Yes, yes. The Gasconade animals.
Right. Yep.
Megan, I would like you, I've got to ask about Frosty Marvin. 513 goats registered, probably one of the most popular bucks. Definitely the most popular goat, in my opinion, that probably comes up on this podcast because it's very quick off the top of my head. But What did Frosty Marvin do for the Nubian breed that probably made him one of the most talked about, both good or bad, Nubian bucks in the history or the history of goats?
Well, I will say, I think it's ironic that the very first AI progeny that I had when I started was a Frosty Marvin son. That was the very first AI success we had, because he was so well known and popular. And he was actually resided over like near us, just a few hours away in the Pepperwood herd when we got into goats. So he was kind of popular out here on the West Coast at that time. I think primarily like his was just the size, the beautiful breed character of what you think a Nubian should be, and the really long bell-shaped ears. He was also a big buck with just a lot of strength and substance of bone. And I think he gave that to his progeny. I mean, he was very consistent in producing that. And being such a popular buck, he then turned out, you know, to be so popular through his sons. Like you guys have Kismet Marvin Smooth Operator listed, and that was a buck we jumped on his bandwagon too, primarily because at the time we were showing youth and Annette Mays was judging, and she had just bought Smooth Operator. So she was really marketing him. But when I think back, you know, we AI'd the Smooth Operator. We bought some daughters from Kismet, and those Smooth Operator daughters were the basis for who we bred our Dayspring Jericho buck to kind of produce that base herd that we started with. So, I mean, they're all definitely very influential in that breed. And I mean, even though Frosty Marvin was popular, Smooth Operator was just as popular. I think he took it up a notch as far as that tall, long style does, the really big productive mammary systems. And they just had this beauty to them. They were so high headed and just these like regal animals that you got the sheer size and the milk production from.
Yeah. We still use that. I got to a buck this past year, Kismet Oh So Fine, whose dam and sire were Smooth Operator offspring. And then also a yacht last year to it, a buck, son of High Caliber Marvin's Big Max, and got kids from that. So I'm still using the Marvin as well. But I think he helped with production as well, body size and production, and the pretty heads sometimes.
So let me ask you two this question here. Is Frosty Marvin and or Kismet's Marvin Smooth Operator still relevant for the Nubian breed today, even though they were born in like 1972 and 1987, I think.
Marvin is a G6S carrier, so I think a lot of people are hesitant to use him because of that. Now, we didn't know anything about G6S back these years and years ago, so I think a lot of people would be hesitant to use them just because they would not want to possibly get carriers. But I think Smooth Operator, I mean, he had a pretty style. His daughters were long-necked, long-legged, pretty nice rear udders. So I think bred to the right does. I think anytime with this, going back to the old genetics, you have to look at the does that you have selected, but I know that you think he could contribute something to.
Smooth Operator, 504 progeny between 1988, and he actually had a kid born in 2023, which I think is cool. 54 champion offspring. That's impressive.
And 32 or 34 of those are daughters.
Yeah.
So he has a lot of champion daughters. I just actually counted those last week.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Anyway, because a friend called me about Smooth Operator semen, so we looked him up. Anyway,
and what Paul said about, you know, the relevance of the genetics today, like there's some bucks that are near and dear to my heart that I'm like, oh, they worked so well, let's go back and use them again. But then I have to think of how my herd has evolved and the genetics that I have in it today. It's not the same animals that I was using those bucks on 20, 30 years ago when I was building my herd. So what I think they're going to do on today's animals is actually different than what I get. So then I'm a little more hesitant to go back too far, because the does are different. I don't have the same animals that those bucks were so successful on. It's not to say they're not relevant bucks. I think it's just finding that right cross to use them on today.
That's an excellent point there on that. I want to skip ahead a little bit to probably one of the most modern-ish bucks, and not just influencing goats here in the United States, but across the world as well. JR Spirit's Dakota Playboy, which was owned by Megan and the Lakeshore herd there. And if you look at that, I just brought him up actually on AgriGenetics. He's 3% inbred on Smooth Operator and 1% inbred on Hacienda's Frosty Marvin. So again, kind of really, you're seeing influence way beyond their times. And, you know, his Dakota Playboy made a lot of waves there in the Nubian breed in those 2010s years there.
Well, and I think it goes back to, you know, so he was a buck that I totally went out on a whim to purchase. But I had first seen his mother at the 2007 Nationals when she won the Milking Yearling class. And then her paternal sister was third place in the same class. And it just so happened that Ruth Ann Strozek, who owned the herd, she had bought a buck from me the year prior. So at that national show, I saw these really pretty milking does. I then saw some kids sired by my buck. And I'm like, you know what? I need something new. I'm just going to try. And so then I had seen that she AI'd her to Dakota. And I asked her to buy the buck. And, you know, at the time, it just kind of worked out where she's like, well, why don't you take Playboy? He's the one I was going to keep. And so we got him, we kind of took a gamble, and he crossed really well. But if I hadn't seen her in person, seen how a buck from my herd crossed in her herd, I probably would have never taken that risk. And even though, you know, people are more known of Playboy, he did have a littermate brother that Marshall Losey had, who has done phenomenal things too. I think they do a lot of the same stuff, but then there's also some differences in the mammary structure. And Playboy Maxim was his name. Dakota Maxim was his name. But I think it's interesting, you know, like that Playboy made the list, because that was a buck who ultimately I was taking a huge gamble on bringing him into my herd.
I don't think you can write the story of the 2010s and the Nubian breed without him. And I saw Paul, you actually used him as well at one point, correct?
I did use him. I got a single doe, and she was really smoothly blended. But her mother was kind of a small doe, a little compact doe. And I was really wanting something longer and stretchier. And I didn't get that with the kid, but I sold the doe though to someone who's actually showing in South Carolina. So she'll probably be showing this year as a 3-year-old. But she had a really beautiful rear udder, just like her dam's rear udder. And she was smoothly blended and had a strong chine and just a real pretty little doe. And she got her restricted leg as a kid. So I just used him on one doe, or at least just got one kid from the breeding.
Playboy, you know, was also used in Dan Green's herd. DKGH, and like he has a son there, Playboy Rocket, who has just done a lot for his herd and then other herds that have used him. That I think it's not always just the buck, it's what, you know, their progeny produce as well that can make them. You know, we did we owned Playboy his whole life, and then we did make the decision to export him to Australia when he was a 6-year-old buck, because we felt we had enough semen here in the States, and we wanted to help expand the Australian gene pool. And so it's kind of neat to see what he's doing in Australia as well, because that initial cross that they got from him are very reminiscent of what I saw in some of my goats. And I feel he's just really making great strides. And it always surprised me when more people aren't willing to work with Australians for exporting, because I think it's kind of neat to see, you know, what happens in those other countries.
Now, one thing we do have, you know, we bought a couple of does, and I've AI'd to a buck, but a couple of those that were sired by Wynwood Farms' Lucky Tyee. And Tyee's dam was a Playboy daughter. So the doe that I bought that was actually a carrier, she was a Tyee daughter. And then I bought her full sister, and then I AI'd to Tyee. So we have Playboy, but it's back 2 or 3 generations through those does that we brought in.
I think one thing as well, when we talk about the great ones here, I think we can't tell the story without Brown Sugar Crown Ambassador as well as one of the, you know, we could talk about some of the impact that he had on those customer doughs, especially in the 90s as well. They're back when I was a wee little tyke, but I only, I remember it. I remember it like it's yesterday, but it wasn't. But Brown Sugar Crown Ambassador, to me, really helped kind of write the stamp on the Nubian breed in those late 90s, early 2000s. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Most definitely.
I think so with the body style, those long, tall bodies, nose, with a lot of milk. You know, I think so.
Elegant. That's what always comes to mind when I think about those animals. They were just elegant.
Yeah.
So who are we missing, Megan and Paul, from the list? That's the question.
Well, you know, I was going to say, on Crown Ambassador, I was going to say, you know, like, he did so much for the breed, and particularly in the Castamere herd. But then his sons, like, did so much for my herd, that his son, Castamere's Crown Excess. He was the littermate brother to Castamere's Crown Ecstatic. And, I mean, he was just a phenomenal buck for us. He's kind of what put us on the map back in 2001, when those first daughters were 2-year-old milkers. And then beyond that, you know, Castamere's Crown Finale was a Crown Ambassador daughter, but then her littermate brother was another buck we used extensively, Castamere's Final Justice. And then those full brother crosses were ones that helped fuel Willow Run when they had, you know, Arizel, the 2-time national champion. She was out of Accidental Tourist, who was the full brother to Crown Ecstatic and Final Justice. So it's like he himself, Ambassador, was a phenomenal buck, but then his sons also like carried it on from him. And then you add in Castamere's LH Full Service, who was kind of the outcross buck. All the Ambassador daughters were bred to Full Service and vice versa. And that was like the winning combination that carried, you know, Castamere's through for so many years. Those two bucks together just continually produced time and time again.
And those are the bucks I have on my list as being really top-notch bucks. Full Service and At Your Service did a good job too for Megan. And then more recently, Nevada Joe, which used by J&M Hardaway, you know, he's line bred a lot on those animals. And, you know, we had a Full Service son, Aesop. So most of our goats go back to Aesop. And then we had an Audacity son, Amazing. And Audacity and Aesop were littermates. So those bucks, the Full Service buck and Crown Ambassador contributed to just about every herd around, I think. Hollenboos, you said a lot, the Star Status from Macon. And I just think the Castamere herd has made such a great contribution. Buchan, considering we haven't bred goats in years, that we're still seeing some of those genetics still around.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring up At Your Service, because it seems like it was just yesterday I was using that buck and he had so much success. And I had seen Redwood Hills had made a post that they were going old school and using Castamere's At Your Service. And I'm like, what the heck are they talking about? That is like one of the best bucks. And but then I'm like, oh, he was born in 1999. I guess that is old school. But it's like funny, like how it just has in your mind that, no, those are like the goats of today.
Well, I'm saying, 'cause I only AI'd one goat this year, and it was the Castamere's LE Exacta, who was a half brother to Full Service, you know. So to me, those genetics are still relevant for the gene pool that I'm using. So I would still use Liaison and Full Service and all of those if they were still around.
Yeah, those are ones that are still in my tank too. I haven't let those go.
I was just going to say, you probably aren't advertising that because you want to sell them, right?
Correct. Most AIs I do because I, you know, want to see what it's going to do. But then I also have to be willing to cull those the heaviest too when I don't get what I'm expecting I want to get.
That's probably a good caveat for everybody to keep in mind when you're contemplating using older semen. And, you know, Paul, you've really made an art out of doing it. And, you know, Megan, it sounds like that you have your own little program that, you know, you like to use some of that older stuff. But for people who are maybe newer getting into it, don't just think because something's old semen that it's always going to be a good breeding for you. Because as my daughters remind me all the time, Mom, that was like 40 years ago. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess it was.
One thing I do for AIing, I've got my data sheet here on my computer that I have. It's based on linear appraisal, but I have all the traits on the column on the left, and I have 15 bucks across the top, like at your service, exact to full service, star status, some of those Troubadour, Constant Shoe, Bluebeard, anyway, and some of my own bucks, Magic and Chalk. And then I have the LA mean scores for each of those categories. So I can scroll across and say, well, who's throwing tall or who's not throwing tall or who's throwing the stronger nose and who's got the really good four-header length. And I know, you know, we don't have enough daughters sometimes to really have valid scores, but it's kind of nice for me to be able to, because I have some highlighted in green and some in blue, because teat placement can be an issue for me. You know, I like plum teat, so I like to see, well, on these daughters, you know, one like Star Status had 32 daughters, so where are those teats placed on those 32 daughters? And teat diameter, and then the final score average, and the PTA for final score. So I kind of try to use that data. And then I'll also go to the agogenetics page where you can actually pull up the bucks' daughters, and it shows how they scored on individual traits. You know, so I like to see, you know, how are they scoring on reps or whatever it might be. So I try to use a lot of the data, especially on these older bucks when there is data there, like Big Max and Smooth Operator had those. Smooth Operator had 94 praised animals. Big Max, the other Marvin Sun had 56. So I've got all this here right in front of me now on the screen, but this is what I go to when I start trying to plan those breedings when I want to AI.
It's so important to have that because I think AI is so readily available and widespread that it's so easy just to like jump on a bandwagon when you see something go and win or, oh, I like that, so let's go and AI to it. But you got to understand too, like the value of AI is to be able to incorporate different genetics and see how they're going to cross before you go like buy the buck and use it on your entire herd. And so not everything works. And like to not jump on a bandwagon and just use something because everybody else is, it's like, I want to see the data behind them. I want to see milking daughters. I want to kind of know what I can expect before I go, you know, incorporate it in the herd. So having all those records, Paul, is a really good way of like knowing, having some ability to kind of predict what you're going to get before you actually do it.
That way, because I like to match, you know, match up the efficiencies with the strengths if I can. And because I've seen lots of really nice does sired by a buck that never threw another nice daughter. You know, it's like, well, I don't want all the buck out of that doe if none of her offspring are going to have her traits or if none of her siblings end up with the same traits. And with the linear appraisal, I mean, I'm one that's really big into the linear appraisal and believing the data. So I know lots of times we don't see the full picture because a lot.
I want to wrap it up here a little bit. I want to talk about some of our favorite Nubians of all time here. And I want to start with Paul. Talk to us about maybe some of the Nubians you haven't mentioned or some of the ones that really stick out in your mind, whether it was in your herd or you just saw her and she took your breath away.
In my herd, I guess, of course, Laura will know this. My favorite was probably Michaela, which is a doe I purchased in many, many years ago. She was born in 86. And my whole herd's basically built around her. But some of my other favorites would be her Michaela's daughter, Mademoiselle, who was born in 95. And she was sired by Faith Farm Genesis. So I liked all the Faith Farm Santana J daughters. I really liked what I saw with those. They were smaller does, but really correct and really pretty editors. And then now I've got a doe I still like. Sired by a buck from around 2000, Chippendale. And I know people thought, you know, why in the world are you breeding to that buck from Capricorn 3 that nobody's ever heard of? But anyway, he gave me some nice daughters. So Mischief is still around, and she's still one of my favorites. But in other herds, there have just been so many over the years. You know, it's like when I go to Nationals, I'm there, and it's always like, wow, I love that doe, or I love something about that dough, but I don't know that there are any specific doughs from other herds just off the top of my head that just jump out as the best dough I ever saw. Now, a lot of the doughs that I remember, though, are from the 80s and 90s because I still have those national show videos. So I go back and watch those when I'm going to AI2 use those semen. I want to remember what those daughters look like. So I still go and pull those videos out. I mean, I still like Gabriel. She was a pretty doe. Banner was a pretty doe. There were just so many pretty does that have been national champions. The Wingwood doe that Megan mentioned earlier from 2012, she was a beautiful doe. But I don't really know that there is one goat overall that I would say from my herd or any other herd is really my favorite overall. I know I just kind of rambled and talked in circles, but there are so many nice does out there that I've admired and would love to have goats in my herd look just like those that I can't just identify one or two, I don't think.
I would second that about Michaela. You know, she's always got a spot in my heart. The very first Nubian that I ever chose as a grand champion when, back in my limited time as a judge, she was exceptional, Paul. She was just beautiful. I would also second what you said about the Santana J-Does. They were something. Eden and Eve, those two does that Chuck Peterson bred, they will just always stand out as just some of my very favorite does. Eden, when she won the yearly milker class in 1989, was just, I just thought I hadn't ever seen a doe as beautiful as what she was. She was so perfect.
And the judge said something similar to that too. From all the videos.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah, she kind of said something similar to that. How pretty the doe was.
Oh, gosh, she was so pretty.
Had so many beautiful does out there too, you know. Wingwood's had beautiful does. I mean, Dan Green's got some. Ollie's had some. J&M, those spotted American does are theirs. I've always loved those does. There have just been so many nice does. I mean, years ago, Winterberry Farm had some really pretty does I liked. I just can't come up with the goat that I really think is the best one in my mind.
Cameron, do you have any Nubians that have stood out in your mind over years?
Yeah, so I will tell you that the beginning of my Nubian experience is starting in 2009 after my dad judged the national show. And when my dad had the opportunity to judge the national show, I think 2009, now that Megan's back on here, 2009 was kind of the year I started paying attention to Nubians. And it was because of that experience he judged the national show. And it wasn't just because he judged them, because it was so competitive that year with the Castomers herd and the Lakeshore herd and the Frankie Jones was there with his Nubians there and J&R Spirits Doe was there and there was just so much competition there. And then we don't even talk about the elephant in the room, which is that Sada herd there in 2009 that ended up being the premier breeder of the Nubian breed there in that and who did very well, but specific goats don't stand out on that. But to me, the Nubians for me began in 2009 and really that doe Cover Girl, who's actually ironically the dam of Playboy, is one of my favorite Nubians of all time.
Megan, what does stand out in your mind as like just the best Nubians when you think of amazing, beautiful Nubians, who comes out to your mind?
The first that I had already touched on was Casimir's Chronic Static. She was kind of who set the bar for us and continued to like make us do several different breedings around her. And then obviously Cover Girl. And then a doe that I bred, Lakeshore Perfect Bellissima. She was the 2005 Reserve National Champion. And it's kind of a funny story on her. I was ready to sell her as a yearly milker because I just didn't like how her udder was shaving before nationals that year as a yearly milker. And Aaron's like, fine, I'll go out and show her. We actually sent her with a 4-H-er to show. She was third place in her class. And then it's like she just continued to get better with age. But she's one of those does that then her daughter this year was the 23 Reserve National Champion, won the same 4-year-old class her mom had done years prior. And but it's also through the progeny now that Bellissima has produced for us. I mean, her sons have just been outstanding herd sires. One of them is Lakeshore Ace Bellagio, who was our Spotless Hill Buck in 2014 that J&M Hideaway purchased. And they've had Premier Sire with him 2 years at Nationals. He produced their reserve national champion and then several junior champions. That just kind of like, to me, just kind of like sets apart that to have a doe that can not only compete and win herself, but to be able to produce progeny, both daughters and sons, that can have an impact on the breed. Another doe that strikes me is Wingwood Farm Sweet Avena. She won her class as a 2-year-old at the 2019 Nationals. And that was another funny story. I was walking into the show arena and she was tied up on the side fence and nobody was standing there with her. And I remember walking by and I looked at Aaron. I said, "That goat is absolutely beautiful. Whose goat do you think that is?" And probably about 10 minutes later, there comes Fauna with the goat. And I'm like, "Oh, that's a Wingwood goat. She's really pretty." So it's kind of nice, like, when you see those animals when you don't know who they are, and then they end up, you know, being some of your favorites. And then there's also another doe, Redwood Hills MC Talasi. I had judged her as a 2-year-old first freshener at the Redga show, and she just struck me. And so then her son is actually the sire of Beauty, who is this year's reserve national champion. And then, of course, I have lots of other older does, but those are kind of the ones that just kind of stick out. And then I guess I will say two Pika. Iron Owl Pika, who was the 3-time national champion for Sonia. She's actually sired by a Lakeshore buck, but she was a doe who was kind of before her time. And that's what made me go use her son, Captain, who then produced our junior national champion, because she was just such a beautiful doe kind of before her time.
Yeah, we didn't even mention Jelly. I mean, so many good goes. Jelly, we have just tons of goats that are so prolific. So good. And I need Megan and Paul's help on this here. There was a doe from the Sada herd that was all white that often comes across my mind in my dreams, but I can never remember her name.
Probably Lemon Albedo.
That's it.
Yeah, she was like the first one I remember of the Sada herd that just really stood out. And they had other white does in the process. And then when you were talking, Cameron, about the... was it 2009 Nationals when Saada won Premier Breeder Exhibitor? They had this doe, Saada Barely Zimri. I think she was first place, maybe 4-year-old. But they were a herd too. We're actually, Aaron was on the whole show circuit with them because they're both from Wyoming. And so we went and saw them before Christmas. And even though they're no longer actively breeding Nubians and have kind of taken on to Nigerians, just the what they have contributed to the breed, but they were always a really small herd, but had this very intense vision of what they wanted. And they just continually, I mean, culling was their number one thing. And they kept a small herd. And when something worked, they just kind of kept doing it. And they would show up at Nationals and usually had some real lookers in their herd.
Beautiful, beautiful goats nonetheless there on that. Megan and Paul, thank you for joining us this week here. If the listeners want to find any more information about your goats, where can they find it? Paul, we'll start with you and then we'll go Megan.
Okay. I have a website, foxwood-nubians.com, or on Facebook, it's Foxwood Dairy Goats and Poultry.
To say my stuff's updated, but it's really old. I promise I'm working on it. So we have a website, lakeshorefarms.com, and then Facebook page, Lakeshore Nubians, I believe it is. And so, yeah, I'm working. I keep saying every year, I'm going to get better at this. But I think the paper sales list was kind of my forte. Switching to the whole digital era, I struggled.
Thank you again, guys, for being part of our podcast and for this really fun dive back into the Nubian world. I know that for me, I love my Alpines, but Nubians will always carry a corner of my heart. And I still think there's nothing that's more beautiful than an elegant Nubian that is just checking all the boxes that walks into the ring. She takes my breath away every time. So you guys are breeders who have several of those in both of your herds. So it's been a lot of fun talking Nubians this week. Cameron, where can people find us as Goat Gab on the web?
You can find us on Facebook, Goat Gab, or find us on the old internet, weebly.goatgab.com, anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, anywhere and everywhere you can get them, you can find the magical powers of Goat Gab.
All right. As always, we appreciate you to our listeners, and we will look forward to having you on our next episode of Goat Gab.